could make those reinforcing feedbacks stronger and could bring forward what I call positive tipping points to accelerate the change we need to reduce our impact on the planet.
From the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, we've been speaking with Professor Timothy Linton. He is co-author of the new paper, Many Risky Feedback Loops Amplify the Need for Climate Action. It was published in the journal One Earth on February 17th, 2023. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim Linton, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Okay, we are doomed. The atmosphere and now the weather's gone off the rails. The pandemic is supposedly over, but thousands of people still die every week. The stock market is shaky. Need I go on? If you know all that, what now? Longtime activist, prankster, and culture jammer Andrew Boyd has a few ideas. His latest book is out. It is called I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. From New York City, Andrew Boyd, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
This book, it isn't a book, really. It's kind of a journey, a pilgrim's progress, if you will. Do you really think it's time for the we are doomed conversation?
No. I think maybe the conversation is we could be doomed if we keep doing the destructive, irresponsible, unconscionable things that we are currently in the process of doing. It's a conversation of we could be doomed and what do we do to both not assume we are doomed and what can we do to not be doomed. So it's like both a question of a emotional, psychological, moral, spiritual orientation to decide that we must act in the face of our possible doom as well as what that would entail. And that's the book takes that up. It's not an easy question. It's not an obvious question. It's complicated. It requires a reckoning and digging down into our souls and sort of working out some strategies and, you know, making commitments and looking at some of the troubling, dark hole that we've dug for ourselves on the many fronts you mentioned, crossing ecological limits and their economic and social impacts in particular. What kind of hope is fit for purpose, given that we've already crossed some red lines that will permanently damage the planet and the life systems we depend on and tear at our social fabric in very unjust and unpleasant ways.
And you founded several movements that connected worried people and gave them some hope in each other. Tell us how the Climate Ribbon action works.
The Climate Ribbon is a global story sharing project, a way for us to move through our climate grief to climate action. Basically, it asks one central question and then a follow-up question. And that central question is, what do I love too much to lose? What's at stake for me? You know, where am I planting my flag here? What matters so much that I will take a stand and do what's necessary to protect it? You know, and we ask that question both in small gatherings in church rec rooms and in the streets of the hugest climate gatherings in New York, Paris, elsewhere. You know, the answers are quite diverse depending on, you know, who you are and what your experience is and what you dig down into and realize matters to you so much that you'll do something about it. One person said, the tree in my grandmother's backyard that I planted with her when I was 4 years old. You know, that was somebody from Macedonia. Other people said, you know, somebody from Southern Florida said, Miami, my city, you know, because that's the level of things that are kind of in the crosshairs that are at stake. An 8-year-old boy from the Rockaways in New York City, which was one of the areas worst hit by Hurricane Sandy, who'd seen all that he loved threatened and almost lost. You know, he said, my books, my toys, my apartment, my friends, my mom. He didn't want to lose that. He'd almost lost that once, and he didn't want to lose that again. And so then people sort of find the thing that matters to them, and then they write it on a ribbon, tie it onto an altar in a church or in a huge tree in some of these larger gatherings, and then alongside thousands of other ribbons, people writing similar things, and then find another one that matters to them, that moves them, and remove it from the big tree that it might be tied onto and tie it onto your wrist and become the sort of guardian of that person's thing that they most treasure. And someone's doing that with your ribbon. So we build a kind of what we called an intimate solidarity, you know, each person taking responsibility for the dearest thing that the other person doesn't want to lose, and sort of having that ground your commitment and make you feel like, you know, we're all in this together at some level. And I'm going to recommit to climate action and doing what I can to lessen the really negative outcomes from the unfolding climate catastrophe. And there's a follow-up question that we sometimes ask people to write on the back of the ribbon, which is, what do I love too much to lose on one side? And then what am I going to do about on the other side of the ribbon? We need to move through the grief, acknowledge, you know, what could be lost, give that its own due and space. Then, okay, what now? What do I do? What can I do? What's still worth doing? That's the climate ribbon.
You're also the chief existential officer, the CEO of something called Climate Clock. What is that?
That is also a global project that creates a timeline. The climate problem is not something that we can solve later. It's something we have to solve now. As Bill McKibben says, it is a timed test. As Greta says, if you're telling the climate story, but you're not including the notion of a ticking clock, you are not telling the true story. We have to accomplish certain things within a certain timeline, or else we are in even worse trouble than we already are. So it is very much a time bound. Thus the emergency, referring to these of the rest of this decade as the critical decade to take action. So if that's true, then there should be a clock that is keeping time, that is getting us on the right time frame, that is tracking our progress on the goals we need to meet within that time frame. So that's the climate clock. And it exists as a monument, first up in New York, but now in other cities around the world, in Glasgow and Seoul, Korea, and Rome, and other cities to come. And then also as a sort of handheld clock, as a tool for activists to hold decision makers accountable that has the numbers ticking on it. And the key numbers are, one, it has both the deadline and the progress we need to make. So it's both got a deadline and a lifeline, or deadline and multiple lifelines. And the lifelines are solution pathways that we need to make progress on. The most notable of those solution pathways is the percentage of the world's energy currently coming from renewables. And that is up to 13.5%. That's a great accomplishment, and it is going in the right direction towards the 100% we need to get it up to, but it is not going fast enough. There's other things that we're tracking, you know, more justice-oriented solutions, including indigenous land sovereignty and et cetera. But let's just focus on the one key lifeline. So we need to get to 100% renewables within the shortest time period we possibly can. And that can happen by the rapid deployment of solar and wind. It can also happen by bending down our use of fossil fuels. So it can sort of happen in both a expansion of the new and an ending of the old. And we need much stronger measures to make the lifeline to 100% by the time the deadline goes to zero. And the clock currently reads six and a half years, basically. Yeah, and anyone can see all of that information, the science behind it, how to get involved, how to get your own clock and use it as a communication accountability tool in your own climate action work at climateclock.world, not .org or .com, but climateclock.world. All the information is there on how to get involved.
Hey, Andrew, weren't you the guy who famously prank bid $1.8 million on 22,000 acres of oil and gas drilling land in Utah just to stop the fossil fuel auction?
No, but that was someone I interviewed.
Ah, I would like to hear about that.
I have done many pranks in my time, but this one I didn't do, and this is one of the greatest climate action pranks ever, or let's just call it a creative direct action, if you will. So this is Tim DeChristopher, who's living in Utah. He's a well-regarded climate activist, and was working with various grassroots groups in Utah trying to protect natural lands from various kinds of fossil fuel and other extraction. And during the very end of the Bush administration, there was an auction off of beautiful red rock lands in Utah for oil and gas leases. And he showed up at the auction. He wasn't sure why, you know, what his plan was. And you know, going to just tell people not to do this, tell people why this was destructive, make a statement. He wasn't sure. But before he could, you know, figure that out, someone said, are you here to bid? And he kind of like had a momentary thought, you know, and he just, his sort of, you know, the gears started to click and he went, yes. And someone handed him a paddle. It was, it said number 70. And then he became famously known later as Bidder 70. And he sort of walked into the auction and then he sort of like was looking around. A couple of things got auctioned off. And then he was like, wait, I'm going to bid. So he started bidding. And yeah, he didn't have any money, but he started bidding and he started winning all these lots, you know, like winning the leases to drill in this beautiful land that he wanted to protect. But he was winning these lots. And then eventually, you know, the auctioneer in charge of it realized there was something amiss because he wasn't recognized and he was bidding all these lots and people were looking strangely. We don't know who this is. So they shut, you know, that the auctioneer sort of stopped the auction. And then he was brought up on charges and made a phenomenal speech at his hearing. About the history of civil disobedience in the United States and how it's won all of these social and environmental victories, and was put in jail for 2 years, and then came out and decided, you know, thing after that. But basically, he went to divinity school at Harvard so that he could meld a faith-based approach to his climate disobedience work. And then I got the chance to interview him. Oh, and then in the end, what happened was because the auction was stopped and it was all got caught up in this sort of bureaucracy and legal sort of gray area. And by the time they sort of sorted it out, Bush had transitioned to Obama and Obama canceled that auction. It was all sort of under federal lands. And so none of those lands got auctioned off for extraction and they were preserved and defended. So this one individual taking an almost slight, you know, he knew he wanted to stop something that was bad, but he wasn't sure how, and sort of by his own wits and bravery and moxie, managed to protect a whole swath of extraordinarily beautiful, pristine, beloved Red Rock country in Utah. So it just became an inspiration for people all across the country. If Tim could do this, what can I do?
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org. Welcome back. Alex is talking with author and activist Andrew Boyd. His latest book is I Want a Better Catastrophe.
Yeah, your book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, it's a pretty serious work. You went out and interviewed seven leading post-doom thinkers, from sort of the doomiest dark places to those with a bit more hope. Some of them have been guests on Radio EcoShock, but other ones I would never have encountered without you. So I think this is one of the real benefits of the book. It's like an introduction service.
Fantastic. Yeah. No, it was an extraordinary experience. As you said, it was a pilgrim's progress, a sort of journey. They're partly chosen for a diversity of voices and also people, you know, who are not pretending that things are better than they are and yet staying, finding an ethical way to stay engaged, depending on the definition, even hopeful way to stay engaged. So that was sort of how I sought them out. You know, mentioned Tim DeChristopher, alongside him, Joanna Macy, an eco-philosopher, beloved by many, Adrienne Marie Brown, sort of a quote-unquote organizational healer and visionary fiction pioneer, Robin Wall Kimmerer, indigenous botanist, Gopal Dayanani, for example, a leading voice in the environmental justice and climate justice movements. And we had these wide-ranging interviews, and that's all captured and poured into the book. And a few takeaways, like Tim, for example, one of the things I was curious about is how do people stay sane? How do they stay grounded? You know, how do they find a, you know, an ethical framework to step forward into this scary, uncertain future? You know, we're all grappling, you know, with these, our own versions of this question. Tim, for example, action for him was sort of a coping mechanism, was the thing that kept him able to sort of stare clear-eyed at our sort of unfolding, or as one person said, you know, our dark and darkening future, you know. So it was through action that kept him grounded. And he likened it metaphorically to a bicycle, of riding a bicycle, you know. Yes, it's wobbly as you're learning to ride it, or it's wobbly as you first get on it. But once you start pedaling, you find your balance. That really struck me and stayed with me, that notion. Gopal Dayanani said, for example, like acknowledged, you know, we're in for a lot of suffering. So let's distribute that suffering equitably, not pretending things are better, but okay. But then what is our response? If we bring justice, if we can focus on justice, make a lot of the decisions about how we handle the crisis as it unfolds through a lens of justice, we might have bad outcomes, but we will have the best of the bad outcomes that are left to us. Adrienne Marie Brown, for example, said something very beautiful that stuck with me. And it was, you know, it's like, yes, we're in for a fall. So let's fall as if we were holding a child on our chest and sort of fall into it, you know, protecting that child, you know, whether that's the people we love, the places we love, you know, the next generation. You know, it's just sort of such a beautiful image of care and compassion and solidarity, and acknowledging that, yes, we're in for a big fall, but that doesn't mean we give up hope. That doesn't mean we fall into despair or doom. No, we have to act with all of our values, knowing that we're in for a tough decades or century starting now. This was some of the wisdom that sort of came to me and that I poured into the book and, you know, was changed by.
Andrew, would you give us a reading?
Yeah, I'll read. It's just one page long, and it is the title track of the book. It's I Want a Better Catastrophe is the title. Climate catastrophe is coming. We know this. What we don't know is how bad it will be. In the best case scenario, an unprecedented global Green New Deal rapidly transitions world economy off of carbon, holding global temperature rise under 3 degrees centigrade. This, unfortunately, causes large-scale polar ice melt, 12 inches of sea level rise by 2050, and major habitat disruption. We lose Miami, Shanghai, and many of our greatest cities. Tens of thousands of species become extinct. Coastal flooding and systemic crop failure lead to hundreds of millions of climate refugees, global resource wars, and partial social breakdown. But enough of us survive, and a chastened version of civilization, one that's learned to live within sustainable limits, stumbles through. That's our best case scenario. In the worst case scenario, runaway global warming of 6 degrees centigrade plus superheats the planet, wiping out humanity and many complex life forms. In the worst case scenario, catastrophe is total. But in the best case scenario, what we do matters. If projections tell us that 1 million of the Earth's species are on track to die off, and we can do something to help make that only 50,000, 500,000, shouldn't we try? We must protect all that we can. We must do everything possible to limit the damage, including gracefully powering down our civilization and becoming lean and resilient enough to survive in a broken ecosphere with our humanity intact. What we want here is a better catastrophe. Imagine the protest rallies. Alex, imagine. What do we want? A better catastrophe. When do we want it? As late in the century as possible. Door-to-door recruitment? Excuse me, ma'am. Care to sign this petition to only half fuck over the planet? A little bit of a joke there, but, you know, captures a little bit of the task of someone trying to tell the truth and do something about it. A defeatist attitude, you say? Hardly. It's hard-nosed, courageous, and full of hope for the future. What was Winston Churchill's rallying cry in the darkest moments of World War II? Quote, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Not exactly an upbeat message. He wasn't one to overpromise, and nor should we. He too had a choice of catastrophes. Europe as a Nazi-occupied death camp, or Europe bombed to pieces and split down the middle with some takeaway wisdom about the nature of evil. He chose a better catastrophe, and so should we. If catastrophe is where we're headed, let's fight hard to get the best catastrophe we can.
Wow. And I also want to talk about, well, a few parts of your new book. They came out in Dark Mountain in 2017 as you were working on it. For example, who are the 12 characters of the apocalypse and how did they end up touring England and Wales?
This was a many years process writing this book, and it began as one thing and ended as another. And there were many different stages of it in between. One of those stages was trying to capture many different perspectives in these tiny little sort of day in the inner life vignettes of how people are experiencing and responding to what I call the impossible news that the climate scientists are bringing to us. So, you know, an eco-anarchist in you know, plotting in the basement, just do eco-sabotage to try to stop the industrial machinery in their city from doing more damage. You know, another was someone who's just decided, I think it was called Let's Party Because It's 2099. You know, someone who just decided there's no hope. We're doomed. So why not just throw caution to the winds and burn as much carbon as they wanted and travel around the world and, you know, stay up all night, you know, in clubs and, you know, lean into the end of times hedonism. You know, there's logic to all of these POVs, you know, these different responses. Other was sort of concerned community member who decides to, we're not going to really try to do things at the national or global level. Let's just fall back to the community level and get our own house in order. We're kind of following along the transition towns prescription, you know, building as just as possible, resilient communities to cause the least amount of damage locally and also be, you know, prepare our towns and communities for, you know, for the impacts as they sort of unfold. So each had very different, you know, perspectives, and I tried to be honor each. There was no like critique. Even there was even a prepper, you know, who's sort of building their bunker and booby trapping it and the whole deal, and just trying to get inside the head of each person and all of these different responses that are sort of happening out there in society, and, you know, but sort of grounded in the inner voice of a particular individual who sort of might be going through that and their sort of reasons and logic and what it feels like to them. And I bundled them together and published this piece on the, you know, Dark Mountains blog. And it was called 12 Characters in Search of an Apocalypse, you know, as a sort of play on Pirandello, the famous, the title of Pirandello's famous play. A few of those ended up in the book, but they not in this sort of cast of characters so much.
I want to move on to the whole question of hope. There is hope, or at least there used to be, and you spent a whole chapter, complete with a wall-sized flowchart, to find the remains of hope and sort of justify it. And I'm wondering, why all that angst? Can't we go on to meaningful lives without hope?
Well, in my cultural scouting and my investigations and talking to people, hope would kept coming up, and people had extremely different attitudes about hope. Some could not imagine going on without it. Others sort of dismissed it as, you know, unnecessary. Let's just, you know, our house is on fire. Let's just do something about it. Hope or no hope. So there are very different sort of attitudes about it, but it kept coming up again and again. So it, you know, arguably this whole book is an investigation into hope and what kind of hope serves us. And I can share a passage from the book that addresses that if you'd like.
I would.
There's a whole chapter in the book with multiple pieces in it called Is There Hope? So in the face of looming catastrophe, we don't know whether to double down on hope or give up hope completely. You know, we're not hopeful because things like the facts are pretty hopeless, but we're not hopeless either because, you know, we love life. We have a heart that still beats, and some part of us will always remain an irrepressible hope machine. It's a paradox, a human paradox, but that's how we do. And so we need a strategy. We need a way to walk our paradoxical path, a way to twin our warring selves. What kind of hope can still serve us? You know, there are many, many kinds. Four that I outline in the book are passive hope, heroic hope, stoic hope, and grounded hope. And I'll just step listeners through those four very, you know, briefly here. Passive hope is super positive. You know, it's almost Pollyanna-ish. It naively trusts that either technology will fix things, or since the Earth's climate has changed before, we'll be fine. You know, the basic attitude is like, don't worry, be happy. You know, somehow it's all going to work out. This might give you some peace of mind, but it leaves little reason to act. And we actually really, really do need to act. Okay, so heroic hope is also hyper-optimistic, but it's far more action-oriented. You know, it lives by the credo, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. It takes a yes, we can. There's no limit to human ingenuity. Just do it kind of attitude. You know, despite their striking differences, you know, between passive hope and heroic hope, you know, they share one important quality. They both depend on results, good results. And when actual outcomes turn sour and dark, you know, or threaten to, you know, as I would argue we're in store for, you know, it's kind of hardwired into our near and far future. You know, this kind of optimism-based hope, this results-based hope can quickly crumble and turn into pessimism. All right. So now what? Aha. So fortunately, we have two other kinds of hope to turn to, stoic hope and grounded hope. Stoic hope says we can handle it. We've survived tough times before. Whatever happens, we can make it through. We can rebuild. You know, and if the worst comes to really worst, I'll drown with my boots on. But you know, this kind of stoic hope, it's sturdy, it's resilient, but it's not particularly proactive or strategic. Doesn't think down the field and take action. It just sort of hangs in there and kind of holds on and tries to get through. But we need to be both proactive and strategic. Enter grounded hope. This kind of hope, grounded hope, embraces the full paradox of our predicament. It says, yes, it's hopeless, and I'll give it my all anyway. This kind of hope is not dependent on outcomes nor attached to optimism or pessimism. Instead, it's grounded in our character and our calling. It recognizes the full difficulty of our situation, yet still chooses to be hopeful. Grounded Hope channels the pivotal insight of Václav Havel, the playwright and ex-president of the Czech Republic. Hope, he says, is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. You know, grounded hope offers us no guarantee that we'll ever walk out of the darkness, but it shows us how to walk through it. Basically, you're doing what's right and what is necessary, and the doing and the walking are their own reward. And it comes back a bit to Tim DeChristopher, the way he explained hope to me. His notion of hope is very different than what you would normally expect. And it was very sort of striking to me. And, you know, his understanding of hope is that it is the will to hold on to our values in the face of difficulty. So I'll leave you with that. That's a lot of what the book is about, is sort of finding the kind of hope that can serve us when we should not be relying on good outcomes, because we've really crossed certain red lines that are going to make our future very, very challenging. So what kind of hope can help us sort of navigate our way forward? A grounded kind of hope. And there's many wisdom teachers have landed there, and the book is full of a lot of guidance from a lot of different quarters for how to, for each of us can find our own way to a grounded hope in this dark time.
Andrew Boyd's new book is I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. Find it wherever books are sold, and I'll include a few more teaser quotes in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for spending so much time with us here at the end of the world.
You are so welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Of the gravity of the situation, believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times.
Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week. And thank you for caring about this world.
We are going to hit 1.5 degrees C warming. When we're going to hit it, well, we could have a year soon, certainly in the 2030s, where we hit it temporarily, and the average will be going through 1.5 degrees C sometime in the 2030s or 2040s. But there's still a lot to play for, because from my own studies of damaging climate tipping points, we know that several are at risk, but those risks go up disproportionately more for each 0.1 degrees C of warming. And the same would be true for other kinds of climate damages and impacts. So every 0.1 of a degree C counts as a simple message, I guess, even though it looks sadly like we're definitely going to transgress that 1.5 degree C target. And unfortunately, current policies, such as they are still taking us into a world that's going to be at least 2.5 degrees C warmer in the second half of this century. And depending on these feedbacks, could be quite a bit warmer than that.
James Baldwin.
I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive.
As long as I'm in this sinking ship and I have a can, I'm going to start bailing and keep working in that direction.
We had an understanding, we thought, of when climate change would begin to arrive. And we got that from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a group of scientists who have to report to governments, I might add, on what they say. And it looked like people were talking about 2040, 2050. We'd see the first really big hits. But the scientists that I talk to now have brought that way forward and say, no, it's happening now.
Yes.
We're getting it right now. We're seeing some sea level rise now. We're seeing storm surges like in Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. We're seeing the Arctic melt, which just blew everyone's mind, frankly. No one had expected that to happen.
Radio Rewind.